or couples who rented by the hour. The doors to our two rooms are closed, but I see the curtain tweak in the one occupied by my kids. That eases some tight knot in the center of my chest. 10 minutes seems like a long time for them to be on their own right now. I feel as if there are enemies all around, and I no longer know who the hell they are. We both start talking at the same time. Sam, I don't know.
I'm sorry that I...
When our words collide, we both fall silent, waiting for the other to proceed. He doesn't. So I finally do. I don't know if I even want to think about moving away from Stillhouse Lake right now. The kids, they only just started to feel safe and... I trail off. He nods. I'm not saying you shouldn't go after that job. You should if it's what you want to do. I won't get in your way. I get out of the SUV before he can think of an answer. I don't want to hear it. I go straight to the door of the kids' room and knock. And before I hit twice, the doors open, and Lanny throws herself into my arms. I walk her inside without breaking that embrace.
I was worried, she says, and sniffles. You were gone a long time.
I'm fine, I tell her. I push her back a little and study her. She's been either crying or fighting not to, and she looks puffy and miserable. I hug her again and smooth her silky, multicolored hair. You know me. I'm not going to leave you. Not even when you want me to, because I'm the most annoying mom ever. She laughs a little and hugs me tighter. I look over at my son, who's quietly watching us above the edge of the laptop. Hey, kiddo, I say. How's it going?
Fine, he says. I'm not the one who's freaking out.
Don't be mean, I chide him.
Yeah,
Lanny says, and turns her face toward him, still pressed against me.
Don't be mean, jerk.
And you?
I bop her gently on top of the head. Quit name-calling.
She's been like that all day, Connor says. I don't care.
He does, though. He and Lanny were each other's everything while I was in jail, then on trial. Even when I came back, they stayed close. They had to. It was us against the world. I know that has to end eventually. But not yet. I can't bear it.
Anyway, this town's really weird, Mom.
It was started because they trapped and killed bears and wolves and things. Then they had an iron mine. But some of the histories say there were gangs of thieves here, too, who used to rob people and bury them in the forest.
Okay.
I sit on the edge of the bed where he's propped up.
That's interesting background. Anything more recent? 3 women went missing, he says.
I like that he's so particular about his nouns. Even at his age, he's not falling into the trap of calling adult women girls, or worse, females. And there are a couple of younger ones who maybe ran away, but maybe not, too.
And a disappearing wreck. It's cool, Mom. Check it out.
He swings the laptop around toward me, morbid delight all over his face. It's a paranormal website talking about recent accounts of a devastating wreck near Wolf Hunter. 2 cars, a head-on collision. A hunter apparently witnessed it from the trees on the hill above, but by the time he was able to get a signal and call the cops and make his way down to the crash site, there was no wreck, no bodies. The tire tracks and crash debris that was left along the shoulder could have been there for days. The article segues into a discussion of a local legend about a deadly crash in the 1940s that left several dead, and a ghostly car that has haunted the road ever since.
Odd.
Marlene mentioned a wreck.
When was this?
Last week, Connor said. But even years back, there was a story about a ghost car that drives that same road. Some people think that's where the missing women went. Maybe the ghost car picked them up and took them away.
Really, Connor?
Lanny's face twists in a mask of disdain.
Ghosts now? For real?
I see the spikes come out in my son.
Like you didn't say Bloody Mary 3 times in the mirror at midnight.
I didn't.
I saw you.
Stop, I shout it this time, over the rising volume,
and glare at each of them until they look away.
Enough.
Connor, thank you. I'm not sure the ghost car is going to help, but anything's possible.
Come on, you two.
I want my laptop back, Lanny says.
Fine, take it, Connor snaps. About time you did something useful. All you've done is cry about your stupid girlfriend not liking you anymore.
The color drains from my daughter's face, then comes rushing back in. She snatches the laptop away, runs into the adjoining room, and slams the door hard enough to vibrate the floor. I turn to my son.
Did you think that was necessary?
I ask him.
Well, it's true. She's been moping around for days and acting like she's the only person in the world. I'm sick of it.
Do you remember how it was after she found out you talked to your dad? I asked him.
What did she do?
He looks away.
But that's different.
No buts. What did she do when she found out you'd gone to meet him? His voice drops.
She came after me. Helped me get away, kept me safe.
She fought for you, baby. She's your big sister, and she'll always protect you. And you should protect her, too. Even from yourself when you're not happy with her.
She started it.
And she's the one hurting right now. So let it go, okay? He nods and crosses his arms. Defensive, but I know my kid. I can see he's thinking and regretting. I give him a hug, a big one, and whisper, thank you, to him.
She's still being stupid, he grumbles.
She's entitled to be stupid sometimes. So are you. But right now I need you to support her, okay? Thank you for looking this up. It's going to help. I have no idea how it will help, but having more background information about Wolf Hunter can't possibly hurt. If Marlene actually saw something, something real, then it gives us something to look into.
Listen, I'm going to go see if I can talk to her, okay?
He nods. I look up at Sam beseechingly, and he says,
tell you what, Connor, I could use an extra pair of hands to help me get lunch. Come on, let's take a ride.
Okay.
Connor slides off the bed and follows. Sam gives me a look as he closes the door. I mouth, thank you, and he nods. We have a lot to discuss, but his love for my kids is beyond priceless to me. I tap on the connecting door. When there's no answer, I go around through the door of room 6 and use my own key to open the door to room 5. Lanny makes a frustrated sound and throws herself on her side to put her back to me as I close the door.
Do you want to tell me about it?
I ask her.
Why? You don't care.
You know that isn't true, honey. She's sobbing quietly, and I pretend that I can't tell. My heart does ache for her, but at the same time I know she has to get past this, grow the armor she needs to protect herself for the next heartbreak. And the next. When I lie down on the bed next to her, she turns and rolls into my embrace, and I stroke her hair and tell her it'll be all right, and she cries like a wounded child. Finally, she hiccups back a sob, and I say, did you talk to Dahlia today?
No,
she says.
Not really. She just did a voice call, not Skype, like she promised. And now she won't even text me back. Her mom doesn't want me around anymore.
She swallows hard.
Is it because she doesn't want Dahlia to be gay?
I don't know, I tell her.
Maybe.
But also, maybe it has nothing to do with you. Maybe it's about me and this documentary thing. If it is, I'm really, really sorry, Lanny. And I'll do what I can to make that better, okay? She gulps back more tears, nods, and after a moment mumbles something I don't catch. I ask her what it was.
She says, how could I have ever loved my dad? What's wrong with me? How could I do that?
I feel the freezing anguish in my chest tighten. I know these questions. I've asked them of myself every day. I hug her closer.
He was your father, I say. We all loved him, at least for a while. The darkness inside him belonged only to him, and we couldn't know it was there. Nothing's wrong with you, okay?
Okay.
She gets up and goes into the bathroom. I hear her blowing her nose, washing her face, and then when she comes back, she looks steadier.
Sorry.
It's all right. I'm sorry things aren't good right now. I wish I knew how to make it better. She lets out a long, shaking sigh.
I need to do something and get my mind off it. Can I go with you? I don't want to stay here.
No, Lanny, I'm going to the jail. She perks up.
You mean to see Vera Crockett?
I wish I hadn't said anything at all.
Yes, but I can help.
No, honey, I'm sorry. I don't think that would be allowed.
But I could be your assistant. I could take notes and everything.
No, I tell her. And I mean it.
Really? Really? Now you're going to tell me to sit here and wait around like some child? Like Connor? V is my age, Mom, and she needs help. I want to help.
And you can, I tell her. I promise you, but not...
I'm going with,
Lanny interrupts me, and I'm not going to argue about it. I know that tone, I realize with chagrin. It's the same one I use to end an argument. Lanny gets up from the bed, walks into the bathroom, and shuts the door. I hear water running. She's going to take a shower. There's a knock on the closed connecting door. I open it to find it's Sam and Connor, loaded down with food. Fast food, of course. There's nothing else in town except one small diner that looks like it caters exclusively to locals. I don't intend to take my daughter with me to do this. No way in hell. Until my phone rings, halfway through my hamburger, and I step away to answer Hector Sparks's call. I've set up the interview, he tells me. Detective Fairweather isn't very pleased, but I think this is a good idea. She's more likely to give us better information if she feels comfortable, and obviously she feels more comfortable with you. I take in a breath, and before I let myself think about it too much, and talk myself out of it, I say, my daughter's coming with me.
Your daughter?
Atlanta. She's 15, around Vera's age. I think having her in the room might be useful and put V more at ease.
You're not, concerned about exposing your child to what Vera might say?
She's heard worse, I tell him. Trust me.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want my daughter to be involved. But this is a child's life we're talking about, and they'll almost certainly decide to try V as an adult, and Tennessee has a death penalty.
We'll be there. Just to be clear, my daughter won't be talking. I will. She's my assistant.
Understood, he says. Thank you, Miss Proctor. This is a great relief. They'll expect us at the county lockup at 3 p.m. It's about a half-hour drive. I will meet you there.
I check the time. It's 1 o'clock. I turn and look at my family. At Sam, smiling at something Connor's saying, watching my son with real love. At Lanny, picking fussily at the amount of lettuce on her burger, her hair still dripping from the ends. At Connor, with that light in his eyes that tells me he's talking about something he cares about passionately. I'll meet you there, I tell Mr. Sparks. I hope I'm doing the right thing. At this point, all I can do is pray I haven't made a serious, maybe fatal, mistake.
Chapter 10. Gwen. Sam readily agrees that we should all take the trip together and check out of the room while we're at it. He seems a little too eager, to be honest, but like him, I find the motel oppressive. Connor's found a place called Wolf Hunter River Lodge that's closer to the forest. It sounds nice and looks comfortable. The pictures don't lie. It sits about 5 miles outside of Wolf Hunter, and it's a modest-size, rustic place with big rooms, a breathtaking view of the forest from the windows, and a cheerful proprietor who seems happy to have us. Once we get to our adjoining rooms, Sam pulls me aside for a quick conversation. I'm taking Lanny with me to this interview, I tell him first thing. Trust me, I think it's important or I wouldn't do it. Right now, Lanny needs to feel useful. Sam doesn't like it, I can tell. But he lets that go in favor of something else. Give me your phone. I do, baffled, and he hands me a brand new one. I look at it with a frown. Another disposable cell. What's this?
Time to change out, he says. I might be a little paranoid about the documentary crew, but we haven't changed numbers in a while. Trust me?
Of course. The kids, too?
Yeah, I already swapped theirs. I pre-programmed in the numbers they might want to call, plus both of these numbers. You've got mine, Connor, Lanny, Kez, Prester, Javier, Mike, and your mom already in there.
I should probably put in Sparks and Fairweather, I tell him, just in case. He hands my phone back, and I add them into my contacts list. Then I hand the old one back.
You'll get rid of them? I say.
He nods. Sam, what's wrong?
Not now, he says. He glances down at the phone he's holding. We'll talk about it tonight.
I check the time. He's right. I need to grab Lanny and get moving if we're going to get to the jail on time. Assuming Sparks' directions are accurate. I knock on the connecting door and Lanny opens it. She's reapplied her makeup and she looks much more together than before.
Time to go?
If you're ready.
I'm ready.
She glances backward and drops her volume.
Connor apologized, by the way.
He didn't mean to hurt your feelings. Not that badly, anyway.
I know,
she sighs.
He's like hugging a tumbleweed, Mom.
So are you. She grins, and I can't help but smile back.
It's a family trait,
she says. You're more barbed wire, though.
Damn right, I say, and hold up a fist for a bump. She rolls her eyes.
Not cool anymore?
Let's just go, she says.
Connor says Sam's taking him for a walk in the woods.
You're sure you don't want to go with them instead?
Duh, I put on makeup, didn't I?
She's right. Half a mile in this heat would melt that carefully applied shadow and eyeliner into a streaky, sweaty mess.
Then let's go.
I second-guess myself through the entire drive to the county lockup. Strong and capable as she is, my daughter isn't an adult. If the last year and our brushes with Absalon and the father of my children have taught me anything, it's that my kids are brave and smart. But they don't always do the wise thing, the safe thing. And they probably get that from me. The county lockup is more secure than the Wolf Hunter PD office, and I have to present identification at a guard gate before I'm given a parking permit and waved into the lot. There are at least 30 other vehicles in the parking lot. Most seem to have gotten rough usage. I pull in as close as I can to the front row and turn to my daughter.
Okay, I say. Now you have to get very serious. Do you understand me? This is not a game,
and this is not a safe thing we're about to do.
She nods slowly.
I know.
Do you?
I search her expression. I'm not joking around with you, Lanny. You need to do what I tell you. The guards tell you. The lawyer tells you. No arguments and no hesitation. If there is any trouble, you get down and stay safe and do not stop for me. Understand?
I'm scaring her. I can see that.
Good. She needs to be scared right now. She doesn't say anything, but she nods again.
Okay, I say.
Let's go.
Don't make me sorry I agreed to this, okay?
We make the short, hot walk from the parking lot to the heavy doors of the county jail. Once inside, we find a well-lit reception area with a massive, intimidating counter that runs the entire length of the room. It's old wood, with a more recent addition of bullet-resistant glass stretching from the counter up to the ceiling. There's just one window open and a line of four people ahead of us. It takes a while. I don't see Hector Sparks anywhere, and there's no sign of Detective Fairweather. We get credentials, though the woman behind the counter gives my daughter a long, judging stare, and go sit on one of the benches. It doesn't take long before our badge numbers are called, and we're directed to a door at the end of the counter that buzzes. A sign says, "Pull only when buzzing or alarm will sound." I wonder how often they have to deal with that. Often enough to put a sign up. Detective Fairweather is waiting in the hall. He does not look pleased, and when he sees that Lanny is with me, for a moment he looks downright pissed off. It doesn't last long, and then he nods to both of us.
"Miss Proctor? And who's this?"
"Lanny," I say. "Her assistant," Lanny says, and dares him to deny it. He gives her a long stare, then transfers it back to me, placing the blame where it belongs.
"This is no place for a kid," he says.
"Odd, because you're keeping a girl the same age here," I reply. "My daughter may be valuable if we need V to really open up about what happened inside that house."
"And you think your daughter should hear that?"
I don't even blink. "I guarantee you, Detective, she'll be fine." At least he doesn't bother to argue. Not that he could block her if he wanted to, because just at that moment, I see Hector Sparks coming down the hall behind him. The lawyer is in his shirt sleeves, no coat, and he looks a little overheated.
"There you are,"
he says, and pauses. I see him take in my daughter standing behind me. It's only a second, and then his attention returns.
"Come this way. Our visit in time is limited."
"By what?" Lanny asks before I can.
"My appointments," Sparks says,
which is an odd thing to say. Surely the rest of the cases he's handling can't be as urgent as a 15-year-old girl with her life at risk. But he turns and walks away before I can ask, and we follow. Detective Fairweather doesn't.
"I'll talk to you later," he calls after me, and I hold up my hand to acknowledge that I've heard him.
If he tries my cell phone, he'll get nothing. I'll have to call him instead. I prefer that, really. As we go down the long straight hallway toward the locked gate, offices open up on the left, bare windowless rooms with desks and filing cabinets, and virtually nothing that allows any humanity. Not a single Beanie Baby or fluffy unicorn calendar. No pictures of families. I suppose it's smart. It keeps everything strictly businesslike and deters any kind of personal ties that employees might be tempted to form, especially with inmates. But it's depressing. At the gate, the three of us are buzzed through by a guard on the other side. It's airlock protocols, with the other gate beyond, and the guard inside protected by a bulletproof office. The county might be small and poor, but the cops here aren't taking any chances. Once we're through that, there's just a row of cells to our right. The first one contains an older woman in a neon yellow jumpsuit who's apparently asleep on her bunk, face to the wall. V. Crockett is in the second cell. She's sitting on the small, thin bed, but she slowly gets up when she sees us. Her gaze fixes on Hector Sparks, but then moves to me. Then to Lanny, who's standing a foot farther back than I am from the bars. "Not going to lie. The girl looks broken. I know that stare. Equal parts dumb confusion and numbness. She has a shock of messy, dark hair, and her eyes are the clearest green I've ever seen. Clear of everything. I don't exactly know what I'm getting us into, and right now, I can't even hazard a guess. A guard has accompanied us this far."
"All right," he says. "Step back, all three of you, against the far wall. Stay there."
I'm pleased to see that Lanny immediately obeys, and I'm half a step behind her. It's Hector Sparks, who seems to not understand the instructions. The guard advances on V's cell, ready to unlock it, but he pauses to repeat what he said to the lawyer. Sparks joins us against the wall. I get the feeling this might be the first time he's ever been told what to do.
"Here's what's gonna happen,"
the guard says to us as he stands next to V's cell.
"I'm going to unlock her cell, shackle her, and we will go ahead of you into the interview room. You stay 10 feet behind me at all times. You're being watched on video camera. Violate the rules and you'll be immediately escorted out."
"We understand," I say.
"She'll be shackled to the table in the interview room. You will not be permitted to go to her side of the table, pass her any items, or touch her in any way. Do you understand my instructions?
Yes, I say, and my daughter echoes me. Sparks takes his time, but finally agrees. We do it by the book. I take the lead. I don't want Lanny getting overexcited, or Sparks arrogantly assuming that his legal status means he's exempt, so they follow behind me. And I make damn sure that there is more than 10 feet of hallway between the guard's heels and my toes the whole way. That's easy enough to track, as there are markings on the floor every 10 feet anyway. He stops at another gate, and I freeze immediately. I feel Lanny almost run into me.
"Hey, sweetie," says a voice from the cells to our right. "Ain't you a little peach?"
Lanny edges closer to me. The woman's soft southern drawl has an edge to it, and I have no doubt the comments aimed at my child.
"You look like you like a good time."
Without looking at the prisoner, I say, "Shut up or I'll pull your tongue out through your ass."
"Jesus, bitch, calm the fuck down," the woman says sulkily.
I look over at her. She's a bleached blonde white woman, ragged and unkempt, thin as a medical skeleton. It doesn't take much imagination to guess she's in for a drug offense. "Sit down," I tell her. There must be something in my tone, or my eyes, because she holds up her hands and backs away from the bars. I've been in prison. I understand how this works. The gate at the end opens. The guard ushers V into the airlock chamber, and we have to wait on the other side. "Nobody else," Cat calls my kid. By the time we're through the double gates, we're in an area with small rooms. V's in the first one we come to, already shackled down with ankle chains to the floor, and her wrist shackles run through a thick metal hasp on her side of the table. The guard runs through the rules again, sounding blank and bored, and then he leaves and locks the door. There are 3 chairs on our side of the table. I take the one on the far end from the door and put Lanny in the middle. V just stares at me, then at Lanny. She ignores Sparks as if he doesn't even exist. Under it, I see a hint of something stirring. Anger, maybe? Hope? Something deep and visceral.
"Miss Crockett, I'm Hector Sparks. We spoke before,"
Sparks says. Nothing. Like she's gone deaf.
"I should say I spoke, and you pretended not to listen. I thought I'd bring in someone you already know to help us both through this process."
Suddenly she turns her stare to him.
"Go away," she says.
"He can't," I tell her. "He's your lawyer. If he leaves, we have to leave too." She doesn't like that. I see a flash of petulance in her face, and then once again it goes blank.
"Fine,"
she says, and sits back. Her chain drags noisily on the table. She looks up at some point above her head. I wait, but she doesn't say anything else. "Is it okay if I ask you some questions, V? I want to understand what happened to you, and to your mom," I say.
"You heard," she says, still looking 2 feet over my head. "I know you heard what happened."
"Part of it, but only after you called me. I need to find out what happened before." V adjusts her gaze to meet mine for a bare second, and then she skips away to focus on Lanny.
"This your daughter?"
The girl's got a quiet, oddly normal voice. "Yes," I say. "She's helping me today."
"Doing what?"
"Taking notes," Lanny says. She reaches into her bag and takes out a pen and paper, writes down the date. Her hand is shaking, but damn if she doesn't sound calm.
"Go ahead."
"Y'all ain't neither one from around here," V says, and it's a velvety, smooth, uniquely Tennessee drawl that I don't have, and neither does my daughter.
"Where from?"
"We don't have long with you," I say as Lanny opens her mouth. I don't want this girl prisoner to know any more about us than is strictly necessary. Just in case. "What happened the day your mother passed, V? Imagine yourself waking up in the morning, and just tell me about that day as you remember it. I say it as kindly as I can, because I'm trying to be generous and believe the weird blankness is her shock and trauma, and I don't want to make it worse. I imagine the police weren't nearly as considerate. V says nothing. Nothing. She just shakes her head and looks down toward her feet, with the mess of tangled hair tumbling forward to shade her face. I promise you, I am trying to help, I tell her, even more quietly. Nothing you say to me is going to be admissible in court. It's only for your attorney to use to try to help you. It'll be okay. You can trust me. If she even hears me, she gives no sign of it at all. She sways a little, like willow branches in a cold wind, and I feel a prickle of goose flesh on the back of my neck. Then Lanny suddenly says, "It's the wrong question, right?" I send her a look that I hope clearly says, "Don't lead the damn witness." But it's worked. V is looking up at us again. No, at Lanny. She even pushes some hair back from her face. "You're right. I didn't wake up, because I never went to bed. I was out over at the cutoff near the river." "Which river?" I ask. "Wolf Hunter River. Ain't no other one around here." "Were you with anyone?" I ask. "No," she says, and I know that one is a lie, because I see her clear green eyes dart away and come back to fix on my daughter again. I don't like that look. I don't like it at all. "Well, maybe some others, but we don't pay no mind to each other. We do our thing, that's all." "So what's your thing?" Lanny asks. I bite my tongue on an impulse to tell her to be quiet, because I have the strong guess that if she stays quiet, I get nowhere. But even Lanny just gets a dull shrug of V's prison-uniformed shoulders to that question. Hector Sparks is avidly following all this. He's staring over his glasses at V Crockett with an expression that seems intent and very interested. It honestly makes me a little uncomfortable. She ignores him totally, like she's had practice. "So," I say, "tell me about the night before, and keep going up to where you found your mom." I think she's going to shut down completely, but instead she finally says, "I went out to score. Tyler had some oxy he bought off some old lady as needed the money, so I got a few. Sharon had a nice bottle of whiskey and some vodka, so we built a fire and shared all around. Dickie came around with meth, but I didn't have none of that shit." She sounds briefly superior. "Then Tyler said I needed to blow him for the oxy, the dickhead. I stretched out by the fire after. The oxy and whiskey made me kind of sick, so I stayed. Tyler and Sharon was gone when I stopped flying. Fire was out." I feel my daughter flinch at the too casual mention of the sexual transaction thrown out by a girl her own age. "So what did you do after that?" I ask. Another shrug, even more apathetic than the last. "Went to school for a hot minute," she replies. "Then I got bored." "Where'd you go?" "Nowheres." "Wolf Hunter's not that big," I say. "Not a lot of places to go. Try to remember." She rolls her eyes. "Hung out at the abandoned glass factory for a while. I got a sleeping bag there and some stuff for when I don't want to go to class." Stuff, I imagine, is some hoarded pills or booze or both. "Did you see anybody else there?" "No." "So what were you doing?" Lanny asks. V suddenly smiles. It's a smile that shocks me because it looks so normal. Like the two of them are just having a friendly conversation, without bars all around, without one of them being accused of matricide. "Good times, girl. Drank, took the last of my oxy," she said. "Just sort of drifted a while." I don't like that answer. "And then what?" "Walked home. It ain't far." She turns her face away again. I can't tell if the smile is still there, but I imagine it is, and fight off another wave of misgivings. "Mama was on the floor.
Gun was right there next to her. Guess they got her, just like she thought they might. I picked it up because I heard somebody outside, so I fired it to warn them off. Thought they might kill me like they did her. She laughs. Laughs. Anyway, it were just the postman, and I missed him.
Detective Fairweather said you had blood on you. Can you tell me how it got there, V?
She doesn't answer that. She freezes up. I let it go because the clock is ticking.
You said they. Who are you talking about?
V shakes her head.
Mama never really said. Just that something weren't right and she needed to get help. I never paid her much mind. She was always on about something or other. She liked all them conspiracy theory people.
Her voice sounds slow, almost sad. I wonder if she's feeling some regret. I ask a few more questions, but V seems tired now, almost sleepy. She doesn't respond with more than one word answers or shakes of her head. Not even Lanny can get a rise out of her. Finally, Hector Sparks says,
Miss Proctor, I think we need to wrap this up. I really do need to be somewhere.
As if his client is keeping him from something more important. I feel a bright surge of resentment and have to remind myself that he is, in fact, my boss at the moment. Company rules apply. He nods to the guard outside who unlocks the door. Sparks gets up and walks out. Lanny hesitates, looking at me. We're out of time. I lean across the table as far as I dare to. V, look at me. You need to tell me the truth. Did you kill your mother? She slowly turns her head and brushes her hair back. No smile, now.
No, ma'am, she says. I wouldn't do that. She weren't a bad woman. She weren't really there, mostly. Not for me.
I don't know if I believe her. I don't know who I'm looking at. Or what.
Are you going to be okay?
Lanny asks V. V gives her a sad little smile.
Nicest bedroom I ever had is here.
It's more than a little sickening, because I'm pretty sure she means that.
Time to go,
the guard's impatient voice. He's holding the door for us. Lanny and I get up to leave. We've gone a couple of steps toward the door when V says,
Wait, your name's Lanny, right?
I turn toward her. So does Lanny. V is leaning forward, picking at a torn fingernail. A bright scarlet drop of blood wells up, and she lifts her finger to let it slither down her skin. I instinctively put myself between her, even shackled as she is, and my daughter.
I know who you are, Lanny, V says.
She's staring past me.
Your daddy was a raper and murderer. Everybody knows that. They likely think you're bad, too.
And what's your point? Lanny, to her credit, doesn't sound shaken.
Just that you know what it's like. I didn't do this. I'm not a good girl, but I ain't a killer. Not my mama. Not like...
Her eyes suddenly fill with tears, but she doesn't cry. She blinks and they roll down. I wonder if she has a born actor's ability to cry on command.
It was dark in the house. I tripped. I fell over her and got her blood all over me. I put my hand in her.
I feel that like a gut punch. She pulls in a breath that sounds painful, and she bows her head.
That's what happened. You wanted to know? That's the truth.
Miss Proctor,
the guard's voice from the door is stern.
Let's go. Now.
I nod to V and usher Lanny out. I still keep myself behind her, a shield between my daughter and the girl I'm still not sure I can believe.
Mom?
Lanny turns to me while we're in the airlock between the cells and the open hallway.
Do you think she's lying?
Lying about what?
Sparks asks. He's checking his phone. He'd missed the last exchange. Too damn busy. I say, if you want something to exploit for the defense, she says she tripped over her mother's body in the dark and fell on her. That's how she got the blood on her clothing, I tell him. Which you'd know if you weren't in such a hurry to get to your next appointment. He blinks.
Ms. Proctor, she's hardly my only client.
You got another one on trial for murder? He pulls himself up indignantly.
That's not quite fair.
Unfair is being innocent and locked up in a place like this, I tell him. Look for high-impact spatter.
What?
Close shotgun blasts make high-impact spatter patterns, which might not even be visible to the naked eye. If she doesn't have that pattern on her skin or clothes, it wouldn't have been possible for her to have shot her mother at close range. I pause. I lower my voice. She says when she fell on the body, she put her hand inside the wound. So it had to have been a pretty close-range shot to punch with that much force. Pellets spread over distance.
Thanks, he makes notes. I'm afraid to ask how you know this.
I make it a point to know a lot of things, especially about forensics. I ask him about the people she mentioned who saw her the night before, and he says he'll follow up. I'm not so sure. Mr. Sparks, I say, are you really going to fight for her? Or are you just checking a box here? He stares at me, and behind the oh-so-inoffensive glasses perched on his nose, his eyes look cold. I've often heard lawyers referred to as sharks, but I've rarely seen one who looks quite so open about it. Then he blinks, and it's gone.
I'll do my best, and what's important is that we believe in her innocence, isn't it?
Do I? I honestly have no idea. Sparks gets a phone call. His conversation is brisk and brief, and I look back toward the interview room where V. Crockett is being unlocked from the table. She lifts her head and looks at me, and in that instant, I do know. I know that V. Crockett didn't kill her mom. It's a gut-deep judgment. I don't like the kid. She's got a boatload of problems to deal with, and the weird crush she seems to have on my daughter makes me deeply nervous. But I'm looking at a girl in shock, reacting in strange and unpredictable ways. Beneath that is deep, traumatic pain. I can see it.
Miss Proctor?
Sparks is suddenly beside me. I hadn't heard him coming, and it makes me flinch in surprise. I see him note it, but he doesn't apologize.
What are your plans now?
Grab my kids and Sam, get out of town, I tell him. I did what I said I'd do. I helped get Vera to talk to you. You have her story now. He seems relieved, which is somehow not what I expected. I'd thought he would have been desperate for more help, but he doesn't ask. He just nods.
Well, drive safely, he says. I wish you the best of luck, Miss Proctor.
You too, I say. What do you think her chances are?
Better than her mother's were, he says.
I don't like it. I don't like how unengaged he seems. A 15-year-old deserves more than that. I can tell by the look on Lanny's face that she feels the same. Sparks goes ahead of us. Watching him, Lanny says, "We don't have to leave today, do we?" I don't answer her. But inside, I'm thinking maybe there's one more stop we could make to get a few things cleared up. Problem is, I think that nobody in this town's going to welcome me, or my questions. There's no sign of Fairweather when we emerge from the cell area and head back down the dull office hallway. Not in the reception area either. So once we're in the car and have the AC going to mitigate the stifling heat, I take my new phone and dial his number.
Fairweather,
he answers. Proctor, I respond. Sorry, new number. I apologize I didn't have time to talk earlier.
That's kind of you, ma'am, but things have changed. I've been reassigned.
Reassigned? I go blank for a second. But you just got started.
I'm sorry to tell you that sometimes that's just how this goes. The evidence stacks up and stands on its own. We don't have any other suspects than V. Crockett. Given that, my lieutenant is pulling me off to work the Ellie White kidnapping, so I'll be out of Wolf Hunter in a couple of hours.
But,
Ms. Proctor, I know you kind of have a personal stake in this, but nothing you told me in your statement gives me any reason to believe V. Crockett didn't kill her mother. On the contrary, it leans toward the idea she did.
She just told me she fell over her mother's body in the dark, I blurt out. I know I shouldn't disclose that. It's attorney-client information. But I know, for some gut-deep reason, that I do not want Fairweather to leave this case. Not yet. It explains the blood on her clothes. Her trauma explains why she picked up the gun and fired it at the noise outside. She was terrified, Detective.
He's silent a moment.
Does it occur to you that she might have tailored that explanation to fit the evidence we found on her?
Yes, but when I was on the phone with her...
You said she sounded disconnected, like she didn't care about her dead mother.
I know I did, but detachment like that can be a side effect of severe shock. Remember the case of the girl in Texas whose whole family was killed by an intruder? She coped by going out and feeding the farm animals. People cope. I think Vera did it by shutting off any kind of emotions. It looks bad that she was probably high and drunk, but it also helps explain her off-center reactions.
Maybe, he says. But you're talking about theories. I deal in evidence.
I shift a little, not daring to look at my daughter. If I find some, will you follow up on it?
I can't make you any promises. I've got a kidnapped child to find. Vera Crockett might be a lost cause, you know that.
Maybe, I agree. But I'm not the kind who gives up. He sounds briefly amused.
Yeah, I certainly see that. I can't promise anything.
Did you ever talk to anyone at Marlene's job? I ask.
Marlene worked in the garage pretty much alone, answering phones and doing paperwork, he answers. Nothing there. She wasn't popular in town. Not a lot of friends.
Why not?
Her daughter's behavior, for one thing. But before that, her grandfather swindled a bunch of people back in the 60s.
Grandfather?
Small towns, he says. Long memories.
I'm guessing the whole reason you were sent to take charge of this case is that the TBI has zero confidence in the abilities of the Wolf Hunter PD. This girl still needs your help. The amusement is all gone when he finally responds.
God help her, then. And you. If you want my advice, Gwen, just let it go. This town isn't a good place. It never has been. My advice? Don't stay here.
He pauses.
I wouldn't, and I've got a badge and the force of law behind me. This town's sour. Just leave.
Then the call ends, and I sit with the slowly cooling air blasting over us, thinking. My daughter turns to me and says, He doesn't want to even try to help her, does he?
I don't know, sweetie, I say. I honestly don't know what he's thinking.
Downtown Wolf Hunter River at 4 p.m. is not exactly jumping. Most stores, those few still in business, are already closed down. A few people are on the streets, mostly clustered near the diner we pass on the way to the garage where Marlene worked. I don't need to look up the name. There's only one garage, a ramshackle, fairly large place built of cinder blocks. Amateurish hand painting spells out garage in uneven block letters above closed bay doors. There are a few windows in the place, but they're covered by graying mini-blinds. An apparently ancient tire special is still in force, from the price painted on the one larger window up front.
This looks deserted, Lanny says.
The sun-baked sign in the window still says, open, and as I check my watch, we're still an hour before the posted time to shut down.
Stay here, I tell her.
Door's locked.
Usual drill, she says, and sounds put out.
I could be your backup, you know. In a strange place, walking into what is essentially a cave full of blunt objects and people with unknown motivations? No, she can't. If I'm not back in 15 minutes, call Sam, I tell her. If anyone tries to get you out of the car for any reason, call Sam. Yeah, I get it, she says. Mom, you've got your gun, right?
I got it back when we left the jail, I reassure her. I'll be fine. Lock up. I'll be back soon. As I wait outside the SUV to hear the locks engage, I scan the streets. We're near the edge of town, maybe a couple of miles out to the motel where we were so recently staying. Nothing seems out of place. And then I back up and look again. There's another SUV on the street. It's parked near the courthouse, a couple of blocks down, and it doesn't look like it belongs here, especially this late in the day. Day trippers to the forest would already be headed home. Those camping out would be settling in. This looks like a rental to me. It's clean and polished, with dark tinting on the windows that makes it nearly impossible to see in. Could be visitors, I tell myself. But it feels off. I can't deduce anything from a car, and turn away. I head for the door, swing it open, and step into dimness that smells of old oil, rust, and mold. I blink. The overhead light is dim in the office area, which is small and plain. A dirty wooden counter, an old 1970s-era cash register bolted in place, a wooden bench under the shaded window. No modern amenities like coffee or water. The jail looked more welcoming. There's nobody in view, no bell on the counter, either. I step up and lean over. The counter has a doorway out into the shop, which is also dimly lit. Not ideal for a place to do precision work. Maybe it's better with the doors open and sunlight bathing the bays, but I wonder just how often they air this place out like that. It smells like an abandoned building with a nasty edge of sewer backup. I'm about to call out a hello when I hear voices. There's a plain wooden door to my right that must lead out to the work area. I try it, and it opens. I expect a creak or an alarm chime, but there's nothing. Definitely voices. I'm facing a sign on the wall that says, Work Area, Watch Your Step, with a jaunty cartoon worker in a construction helmet pointing at the words. It looks as ancient as this place feels. It's hard to tell where the voices are coming from. Somewhere to my left, I finally realize. And when I look that way, I see there's an office behind the reception area that has another door into the work area. It's shut now, but light is leaking around the uneven, warped edges. I head that way. I stop when I can hear what they're saying.
Goddamn girl is talking,
a deep, raspy voice I don't know says.
You said she didn't know nothing about it. So what's she got to say to that bitch?
That bitch has to be me. Goddamn girl must be V. Crockett. I guess that's not unexpected in one sense. Either Vera, Marlene, or my involvement must be the topic of most Wolf Hunter conversations right now. But it feels alarming.
No idea,
another male voice says, and it sounds familiar. I've heard it somewhere before, but I can't nail it down. Maybe at the police station?
Damn county idiots wouldn't listen in, so we don't know. You never should have let them move her to county, Weldon. I didn't have a choice. That TBI man, he did it. If I could have kept her here, we'd have been done with it already.
A new voice now.
Boys, boys, calm down, we're fine. Chances are Vera didn't say anything that makes any sense anyway, and Marlene knew better than to run her mouth, didn't she?
Well, Weldon says bitterly,
she damn sure forgot, because why did she call that stranger in the first place? Now we got that damn woman to deal with, and her boyfriend and kids. It's a damn mess, Carl. This was supposed to be easy. It is easy, Carl replies.
He sounds, well, like he's used to being in charge.
It's containable. Well, then you better get to it and fast,
the original voice says. No one's given him a name yet.
When's our money coming?
Tomorrow or the next day, Carl says. I told you, it takes time for the transfers to process. If you want it untraceable, then it'll take 3 or 4 offshore banks.
My mind's working furiously now. What are they talking about? What money? What did Marlene know? Doesn't matter. I've heard enough. We need to get the hell out of here. Now. I back away toward the door and ease it open behind me. It runs into something. It hits a man about 6 feet tall, wearing oily mechanic's overalls, wiping grease from his hands. He's more than twice as broad as I am, and tops me by several inches. His biceps look enormous beneath the sleeves. I notice those more than I do his face, which is mostly in shadow. As is normal in this town, he's a white guy, and he looks like he crushes metal for a hobby.
"What are you doing here?"
he asks me sharply.
"Customers ain't allowed out here."
"I was just looking for someone to help me," I say, and try a placating smile. I'm not sure it works. His body language stays militant. "Maybe you can. How much for an oil change?" It's the first, most normal thing I can think of. It works, because he relaxes a little and steps back to let me come back into the reception area.
"You should talk to..."
He glances toward the counter, then looks grim. I don't know why until he says,
"Well, ain't nobody working the counter these days. The boss, I guess."
"Who's the boss?"
"Mr. Carr,"
he says, and he raises his voice.
"Hey, boss, got a lady out here wants to talk to you."
It's the last thing I wanted, but I can't bolt. The mechanic is between me and the outer door. I try edging over. He moves to block me, and I hear footsteps behind me, heavy and quick.
"Miss Proctor,"
says the voice I first heard from that office, the deep, raspy one. I turn to face him. He's almost as tall as his mechanic, but thinner. Lanky, the way only some country folk are. Older, maybe in his early 60s, with a wild explosion of white hair that ought to soften his long, lean face, but doesn't. Paler than I would have expected, and with shocking blue eyes that look like a doll's eyes. He's smiling, but I can tell that's just a muscle movement, not emotion. There is emotion in him, but it's banked and burning behind those eyes. "Mr. Carr," I say. I extend my hand. He ignores it, so I drop it back to my side.
"You've been waiting long?"
he asks, meaning, have I overheard his conversation with the other two in the office? "Not long," I tell him. Let him make of that what he wants. I don't say anything else. I wait to see what he's going to do. I'm aware, acutely aware, that I might not leave this room without a fight. Or alive. I'm fast on the draw, but even the fastest can go down before they get off a shot, and all he has to do is signal the mechanic behind me to put me in a bear hug. But I have a hole card.
"And what is it you came for? Car running rough?"
He's playing with me. I hear the mechanic move away from behind me. Checking out the window, probably. I see Carr's eerie blue eyes move from me to him, then back. Oh, God. They know my kids in the SUV. I know Lanny. I know she won't open that door for anyone but me, Sam, or Connor. But they could break a window. Drag her out. Would they do that? Ride out in public, on the main street? I heard Marlene Crockett used to work here.
Yeah?
I really just came to ask if she ever mentioned her daughter Vera threatening her, I say. I know he'll take the easy answer. He doesn't disappoint.
"Marlene was scared to death of that damn girl," he says. "No discipline in that house without a man to lay down the law. Vera did as she wanted. Drugs, drinking, whoring around. That all you wanted to know? Could have asked anybody."
His chuckle sounds like a knife scraping concrete. "Thanks," I tell him. "Cops been by to ask about it already?"
"That's my business. Y'all best be going,"
he says.
"Mrs. Melvin Royal, be careful on those dark roads out there on your way home."
I turn my back on him and walk toward the mechanic, who's still blocking the door. I don't stop. I see the man squint past me at Carr, and he moves at the last second. I walk out of the dark shop and into the clean sunlight. That place, that smell. Rust and oil, sewage and baked-in rot. And those men, unafraid to threaten me.
My word against theirs, sure. But I could feel the odds being calculated, the cold decisions being made. We need to get out. Now. I unlock the SUV from the key fob and climb in. In 10 seconds, I've belted in, started the engine, and have it backed out onto Main Street. Car's right. The woods get dark early, and I can see him watching now from his window, blinds pulled up to follow our progress. I check behind us. The black SUV is still parked a couple of blocks away. Now another one has joined it on the other side of the street. I watch, but they don't follow us. Mom? Lanny's watching me. What's wrong? Everything, I tell her. That's when my phone rings. It's Connor. And he tells me Sam's under arrest.
Chapter 11. Sam. The manager of the lodge tells us the best path to follow for a safe, unchallenging hike, one that'll last a couple of hours at most and bring us back in a loop. Connor doesn't seem that interested at first, though he's happy to be tagging along. But the quiet of the forest turns out to be just what he needs, and it eases some of the vibrating tension inside me, too. Something about the green, fresh smell of the air, the flickering shade, the sound of birds singing. Makes you forget all the bullshit for a while, even if it's bullshit of your own making. We walk up the trail a bit, and I stop to point out an almost invisible snake, non-poisonous, so I let him get closer than I would have otherwise. The snake flees without any show of anger, and we keep going. That was cool, Connor says. It was. I'd like to have a pet snake. That'd be interesting. Sure, I say. You know you have to feed him what he'd eat out here, right? Bugs, mice, things like that. I could catch them around the lake, he says. It'd be okay. I try to guess how Gwen would feel about that, and fail. Though odds are, if Connor really is interested, she'd be 100% behind that enthusiasm, even if it means having live mice in the house. Lanny might not be quite as accepting. I don't enjoy thinking about the epic battles or the inevitable Save the Mice campaign. While I'm thinking about that, though, Connor says, Can I ask you a real question? For real. How do you ask a fake question? He gives me a look that tells me he isn't amused, and he's serious. Are you and Mom staying together or not? Wow. Will you tell me? Buddy, I would if I had a good answer for it. Don't say it's complicated. It's not. You either love her or you don't. And if you don't, you shouldn't make her think you do. I think about that. We walk on in silence for a while. Connor silently points out a frog by the side of the trail, watching us with unblinking eyes. It hops off into leaf litter as we pass. Okay, I finally tell him. It's not complicated. But it is hard. You get why, right? Because of your sister, he says. Yeah. And because she can't forget it. Neither can I. So, long term, will we be together? I hope we will, but I can't make you that promise. Especially now. Especially with Miranda and all that ugly stained past coming back like a sewage flood to sweep us away. Well, you should promise, he says. Because then you'll stay no matter what. You don't break your promises. I feel a fist close around my heart and squeeze. I want to, I tell him. And it'd be a real easy thing to do because I love your mom, and I love you and your sister. But you won't promise, he says and kicks a rock. Not yet, I say. Ask me again at the end of the week. He gives me an odd look, wary. Why? What happens at the end of the week? That's just it, I say. Hell if I know. That's the point. He gives me a little shove. I give it back. I get a rare, clear laugh from him. You're kind of dumb. Did you know that? He says. Only kind of? I make a snap decision. Come on, follow me. But... He points straight ahead as I veer off. The trail's that way. Yep, I say. Come on, let's get lost for a while. We go for about 15 minutes, and then Connor spots a deer. He starts to speak, and I put a finger to my lips and slowly sink into a crouch behind the brush. He follows suit, carefully mirroring me. I stay very still as the deer comes closer, closer. I wonder if anyone's ever taken this kid hunting. It was something that bonded me and my adoptive father closely in my teen years. Then I think again about whether or not that would be a good idea, given the inevitable associations with his dad's murders and the way he killed. This kid's already had enough death in his life. We sit crouched in the brush and watch the deer as it crops plants and scrapes at the ground for more. She's a pretty doe, and we just appreciate her for a while. When she wanders off, we stand up, and I realize that there's a new path, barely used, going in a different direction. It's not an officially marked trail, more like a game trail. "Can we?" Connor asks and points to it. "Sure," I say. "And if we get lost, what are you going to do?" He pulls a compass from his pocket. It's attached to a small keychain with a carabiner on it, and he clips the carabiner onto his belt loop. "Go southeast," he says. "Why?" "Is this a test?" "Yeah, so?" "Because the nearest place is the lodge, and the lodge is southeast from us right now, right?" The kid's got a good sense of direction and spatial awareness. Good. "And what's in your backpack?" "Trail bars, flashlight, water, map, my first aid kit, and a book," he says. "I know you didn't tell me to get the book." "Good man. Nothing wrong with a book. Let's find a good spot to sit and read." I have a light pack with me, too. Compass, food, water, map of the area, and a slender volume of Garrison Keillor, but I don't tell him that yet. I also have my Glock 9mm and a hunting knife, a pocket fishing kit, and insulating blankets in case we get stuck out here for the night. Because one thing my time in Afghanistan taught me was don't go if you're not ready to face what's out there. And though this ought to be friendly territory, I never assume